across the pages of these vulgar publications, W and Architectural Digest and the rest of them, had she? Oh, no, not for a minute. And what was he left with? A 40-year-old bolting off to her sports training classes. And all at once, he sees her as he first saw her that night 14 years ago in the village, at Hal Thorndike's apartment with the chocolate-brown walls and the huge table covered with obelisks and the crowd that went considerably beyond bohemian, if he understood bohemian, and the girl with the light brown hair and the fine, fine features and the wild, short, skimpy dress that revealed so much of her perfect little body. And all at once, he feels the ineffable way they closed themselves up in the perfect cocoon in his little apartment on Charles Street and her little apartment on West 19th, immune to all that his parents and Buckley and St. Paul's and Yale had ever imposed on him. And he remembers how he told her in practically these words that their love would transcend everything. And now she, 40 years old, starved and sports-trained to near perfection, goes crying off to bed. He slumped back in the swivel chair once more. Like many a man before him, he was no match, at last, for a woman's tears. He hung his noble chin over his collarbone. He folded. Absent-mindedly, he pressed a button on the desktop. The tambour door of a faux Sheraton cabinet rolled back, revealing the screen of a television set. Another of his dear, weeping decorator's touches. He opened the desk drawer and took out the remote control gadget and clicked the set to life. The news. The mayor of New York. A stage. An angry crowd of black people. Harlem. A lot of thrashing about. A riot. The mayor takes cover, shouts, chaos, a real rhubarb. Absolutely pointless. To Sherman, it had no more meaning than a gust of wind. He couldn't concentrate on it. He clicked it off. She was right. The master of the universe was cheap. And he was rotten. And he was a liar. Chapter 2. Gibraltar. The next morning, to Lawrence Kramer, she appears, from out of a feeble gray dawn, the girl with brown lipstick. She stands right beside him. He can't make out her face, but he knows she's the girl with brown lipstick. He can't make out any of the words, either, the words that tumble like tiny pearls from between those lips with brown lipstick, and yet he knows what she's saying. "Stay with me, Larry. Lie down with me, Larry." He wants to. He wants to. He wants nothing more in this world. Then why doesn't he? What holds him back from pressing his lips upon those lips with brown lipstick? His wife, that's what. His wife. His wife. His wife. His wife. His wife. He woke up to the pitch and roll of his wife crawling down to the foot of the bed. What a flabby, clumsy spectacle. The problem was that the bed, a queen size resting on a plywood platform, was nearly the width of the room, so you had to crawl down or otherwise traverse the length of the mattress to reach the floor. Now she was standing on the floor and bending over a chair to pick up her bathrobe. The way her flannel nightgown came down over her hips, she looked a mile wide. He immediately regretted thinking any such thought. He tingled with sentiment. My Rhoda. After all, she had given birth just 3 weeks ago. He was looking at the loins that had brought forth his first child. A son. She didn't have her old shape back yet. He had to allow for that. Still, that didn't make the view any better. He watched her wiggle into the bathrobe. She turned toward the doorway. A light came from the living room. No doubt the baby nurse, who was from England, Miss Efficiency, was already up and waxing efficient. In the light he could see his wife's pale, puffy, undecorated face in profile. Only 29, and already she looked just like her mother. She was the same person all over again. She was her mother. No two ways about it. It was only a matter of time. She had the same reddish hair, the same freckles, the same chubby peasant nose and cheeks, even the beginning of her mother's double chin, a Jenta in embryo, little Gretel of the shtetl, young and yitzy on the Upper West Side. He narrowed his eyelids to slits so that she wouldn't know he was awake. Then she left the room. He could hear her saying something to the baby nurse and to the baby. She had a way of saying, "Joshua," in baby cadence. That was a name he was already beginning to regret. If you wanted a Jewish name, what was wrong with Daniel or David or Jonathan? He pulled the covers back up over his shoulders. He would return to the sublime narcosis of sleep for another 5 or 10 minutes. He would return to the girl with brown lipstick. He closed his eyes. It was no use. He couldn't get her back. All he could think of was what the rush to the subway would be like if he didn't get up now. So he got up. He walked down the mattress. It was like trying to walk along the bottom of a rowboat, but he didn't want to crawl. So flabby and clumsy. He was wearing a T-shirt and BVD shorts. He became aware that he had that common affliction of young men, a morning erection. He went to the chair and put on his old plaid bathrobe. Both he and his wife had started wearing bathrobes since the English baby nurse had come into their lives. One of the apartment's many tragic flaws was that there was no way of getting from the bedroom to the bathroom without going through the living room, where the nurse slept on the convertible couch and the baby resided in a crib beneath a music box mobile hung with tiny stuffed clowns. He could hear it now. The music box played the tune, "Send in the Clowns." It played it over and over again.
Plink, 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 plink. Plink, 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 plink. Plink, plink. Plink, plink.
He looked down. The bathrobe did not do the trick. It looked as if there was a tent pole underneath it. But if he bent over like this, it wasn't noticeable. So he could walk through the living room and let the baby nurse see the tent pole, or he could walk through hunched over as if he had a back spasm. So he just stood where he was, in the gloom. The gloom was right. The presence of the baby nurse had made him and Rhoda acutely aware of what a dump they lived in. This entire apartment, known as a 3.5 room in New York real estate parlance, had been created out of what had once been a pleasant but by no means huge bedroom on the third floor of a townhouse with 3 windows overlooking the street. The so-called room he now stood in was really nothing more than a slot that had been created by inserting a plasterboard wall. The slot had one of the windows. What was left of the original room was now called a living room, and it had the other 2 windows. Back by the door to the hallway were 2 more slots, one for a kitchen 2 people couldn't pass each other in, and the other for a bathroom. Neither had a window. The place was like one of those little ant colonies you can buy, but it cost them $888 a month, rent stabilized. If it hadn't been for the rent stabilization law, it would have cost probably $1,500, which would be out of the question. And they had been happy to find it. My God, there were college graduates his age, 32, all over New York, who were dying to find an apartment like this, a 3.5, with a view, in a townhouse, with high ceilings, rent stabilized in the West 70s. Truly pathetic, wasn't it? They could barely afford it when they were both working and their combined salaries had been $56,000 a year, $41,000 after deductions. The plan had been that Rhoda's mother would give them the money as a sort of baby present to hire a baby nurse for 4 weeks while Rhoda got back on her feet and went back to work. In the meantime, they would find an au pair girl to live in and look after the baby in return for room and board. Rhoda's mother had come through with her part of the plan, but it was already obvious that this au pair girl, who was willing to sleep on a convertible couch in the living room in an ant colony on the West Side, did not exist. Rhoda would not be able to go back to work. They were going to have to get by on his $25,000 after taxes, and the yearly rent here in this dump, even with the help of rent stabilization, was $10,656. Well, at least these morbid considerations had restored his bathrobe to a decent shape, so he emerged from the bedroom. "Good morning, Glenda," he said.
"Oh, good morning, Mr. Kramer,"
said the baby nurse. Very cool and British, this voice of hers. Kramer was convinced he really couldn't care less about British accents or the Brits themselves. In fact, they intimidated him, the Brits and their accents. In the baby nurse's O, a mere O, he detected a whiff of, "Finally getting up, are we?" A plump 50-ish woman, she was already efficiently turned out in her white uniform. Her hair was pulled back into a perfect bun. She had already closed up the convertible couch and put the cushions back in place, so that it had resumed its daytime mode as a dingy yellow synthetic linen-covered piece of parlor furniture. She sat on the edge of the thing, her back perfectly straight, drinking a cup of tea. The baby was lying on his back in his crib, perfectly content. Perfectly was the woman's middle name. They had found her through the Goff Agency, which an article in the home section of the Times had listed as one of the best and most fashionable. So they were paying the fashionable price of $525 a week for an English baby nurse. From time to time she mentioned other places where she had worked. Always it was Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Sutton Place. Well, too bad. Now you're getting an eyeful of a jack-legged walk-up on the West Side. They called her Glenda. She called them Mr. Kramer and Mrs. Kramer instead of Larry and Rhoda. Everything was upside down. Glenda was the very picture of gentility, having tea, while Mr. Kramer, lord of the ant colony, came tramping through to the bathroom, barefooted, bare-legged, tousle-headed, wearing a tattered old plaid bathrobe. Over in the corner, under an extremely dusty Dracaena fragrans plant, the TV set was on. A commercial flared to an end, and some smiling heads began talking on the Today Show. But the sound was not on. She wouldn't be so imperfect as to have the TV blaring. What on earth was she really thinking, this British arbiter, sitting in judgment on an appalling fold-out sofa, upon the squalor of Shea Kramer? As for the mistress of the household, Mrs. Kramer, she was just emerging from the bathroom, still in her bathrobe and slippers.
"Larry," she said, "look at my forehead. I think there's something there, like a rash. I saw it in the mirror."
Still foggy, Kramer tried to look at her forehead. "It's nothing, Rhoda. It's like the beginning of a pimple." That was another thing. Since the baby nurse had arrived, Kramer had also become acutely aware of the way his wife talked. He had never noticed it before, or hardly. She was a graduate of New York University. For the past 4 years, she had been an editor at Waverly Place Books. She was an intellectual, or at least she seemed to be reading a lot of the poetry of John Ashbery and Gary Snyder when he first met her, and she had a lot to say about South Africa and Nicaragua. Nevertheless, a forehead was a fahead, and there had no R at the end, but saw did. That was like her mother, too. Rhoda padded on by, and Kramer entered the bathroom slot. The bathroom was pure tenement life. There was laundry hanging all along the shower curtain rod. There was more laundry on a line that ran diagonally across the room, a baby's zip-up suit, two baby bibs, some bikini panties, several pairs of pantyhose, and God knew what else. None of it the baby nurses, of course. Kramer had to duck down to get to the toilet. A wet pair of pantyhose slithered over his ear. It was revolting. There was a wet towel on the toilet seat. He looked around for some place to hang it. There was no place. He threw it on the floor. After urinating, he moved 12 or 14 inches to the sink and took off his bathrobe and his T-shirt and draped them over the toilet seat. Kramer liked to survey his face and his build in the mornings. What with his wide, flat features, his blunt nose, his big neck, nobody ever took him for Jewish at first. He might be Greek, Slavic, Italian, even Irish. In any event, something tough.
He wasn't happy that he was balding on top, but in a way that made him look tough, too. He was balding the way a lot of professional football players were balding, and his build. But this morning, he lost heart. Those powerful deltoids, those massive, sloping trapezii, those tightly bunched pectorals, those curving slabs of meat, his biceps. They looked deflated. He was fucking atrophying. He hadn't been able to work out since the baby and the baby nurse arrived. He kept his weights in a carton behind the tub that held the Dracaena plant, and he worked out between the plant and the couch. And there was no way in the world he could work out, could grunt and groan and strain and ventilate and take appreciative looks at himself in the mirror in front of the English baby nurse, or the mythical au pair girl of the future, for that matter. Let's face it. It's time to give up those childish dreams. You're an American work-a-daddy now. Nothing more. When he left the bathroom, he found Rhoda sitting on the couch next to the English baby nurse, and both of them had their eyes pinned on the TV set, and the sound was up. It was the news segment of the Today Show. Rhoda looked up and said excitedly,
"Look at this, Larry. It's the mayor. There was a riot in Harlem last night. Someone threw a bottle at him."
Kramer only barely noticed that she said mayor for mayor and bottle for bottle. Astonishing things were happening on the screen. A stage, a melee, heaving bodies, and then a huge hand filled the screen and blotted out everything for an instant. More screams and grimaces and thrashing about, and then pure vertigo. To Kramer and Rhoda and the baby nurse, it was as if the rioters were breaking through the screen and jumping onto the floor right beside little Joshua's crib. And this was the Today Show, not the local news. This was what America was having for breakfast this morning, a snootful of the people of Harlem rising up in their righteous wrath and driving the white mayor off the stage in a public hall. There goes the back of his head right there, burrowing for cover. Once he was the mayor of New York City. Now he is the mayor of white New York. When it was over, the three of them looked at one another, and Glenda, the English baby nurse, spoke up with considerable agitation.
"Well, I think that's perfectly disgusting. The colored don't know how good they've got it in this country, I can tell you that much. In Britain, there's not so much as a colored in a police uniform, much less an important public official the way they have here. Why, there was an article just the other day. There's more than 200 coloreds who are mayors in this country, and they want to bash the mayor of New York about. Some people don't know how well off they are, if you ask me."
She shook her head angrily. Kramer and his wife looked at each other. He could tell she was thinking the same thing he was. Thank God in heaven. What a relief. They could let their breaths out now. Miss Efficiency was a bigot. These days, the thing about bigotry was it was undignified. It was a sign of low-rent origins, of inferior social status, of poor taste. So they were the superiors of their English baby nurse, after all. What a fucking relief. The rain had just about stopped when Kramer started walking to the subway. He was wearing an old raincoat over his usual gray suit, button-down shirt, and necktie. He had on a pair of Nike running shoes, white, with stripes on the sides. He carried his brown leather dress shoes in a shopping bag, one of those slippery white plastic bags you get at the A&P. The subway stop, where he could catch the D train to the Bronx, was at 81st Street and Central Park West. He liked to walk across to Central Park West on 77th Street and then walk up to 81st, because that took him past the Museum of Natural History. It was a beautiful block, the most beautiful block on the West Side, to Kramer's way of thinking, like a street scene in Paris. Not that he had ever been to Paris. 77th Street was very wide at that point. On one side was the museum, a marvelous Romanesque revival creation in an old reddish stone. It was set back in a little park with trees. Even on a cloudy day like this, the young spring leaves seemed to glow. Verdant was the word that crossed his mind.
On this side of the street where he was walking was a cliff of elegant apartment houses overlooking the museum. There were doormen. He got glimpses of marbled halls. And then he thought of the girl with brown lipstick. He could see her very clearly now, much more clearly than in the dream. He clenched his fist. Damn it! He was going to do it. He was going to call her. He was going to make that telephone call. He'd have to wait until the end of the trial, of course, but he was going to do it. He was tired of watching other people lead the life. The girl with brown lipstick. The two of them, looking into each other's eyes across a table in one of those restaurants with blonde wood and exposed brick and hanging plants and brass and etched glass and menus with crayfish natchez and veal and plantains mesquite and cornbread with cayenne pepper. Kramer had that vision comfortably in place when just up ahead, from the swell-looking doorway of 44 West 77th Street, emerged a figure that startled him. It was a young man, almost babyish in appearance, with a round face and dark hair neatly combed back. He was wearing a covert cloth Chesterfield topcoat with a golden brown velvet collar and carrying one of those burgundy leather attaché cases that come from Madler or T. Anthony on Park Avenue and have a buttery smoothness that announces, "I cost $500." You could see part of the uniformed arm that held the door open for him. He was walking with brisk little steps under the canopy across the sidewalk toward an Audi sedan. There was a driver in the front seat. There was a number, 271, in the rear side window. A private car service. And now the doorman was hurrying out, and the young man paused to let him catch up and open the sedan's rear door. And this young man was Andy Heller. No doubt about it whatsoever. He had been in Kramer's class at Columbia Law School. And how superior Kramer had felt when Andy, chubby, bright little Andy, had done the usual thing, namely gone to work downtown for Angstrom and Molnar. Andy and hundreds like him would spend the next 5 or 10 years humped over their desks, checking commas, document citations, and block phrases to zip up and fortify the greed of mortgage brokers, health and beauty aid manufacturers, merger and acquisition arbitragers, and reinsurance discounters. While he, Kramer, would embrace life and wade up to his hips into the lives of the miserable and the damned and stand up on his feet in the courtrooms and fight mano a mano before the bar of justice. And that was the way it had, in fact, turned out. Why, then, did Kramer now hold back? Why didn't he march right up and sing out, "Hi, Andy"? He was no more than 20 feet from his old classmate. Instead, he stopped and turned his head toward the front of the building and put his hand to his face, as if he had something in his eye. He was damned if he felt like having Andy Heller, while his doorman held his car door open for him and his driver waited for the signal to depart, he was damned if he felt like having Andy Heller look him in the face and say, "Larry Kramer, how you doing?" And then, "What you doing?" And he would have to say, "Well, I'm an assistant district attorney up in the Bronx." He wouldn't even have to add, "Making $36,000 a year." That was common knowledge. All the while, Andy Heller would be scanning his dirty raincoat, his old gray suit, which was too short in the pants, his Nike sneakers, his A&P shopping bag. Fuck that. Kramer stood there with his head turned, faking a piece of grit in his eye until he heard the door of the Audi shut. It sounded like a safe closing. He turned around just in time to catch a nice, fluffy little cloud of German luxury auto fumes in his face as Andy Heller departed for his office. Kramer didn't even want to think about what the goddamn place probably looked like. On the subway, the D train, heading for the Bronx, Kramer stood in the aisle, holding onto a stainless steel pole while the car bucked and lurched and screamed. On the plastic bench across from him sat a bony old man who seemed to be growing like a fungus out of a backdrop of graffiti. He was reading a newspaper. The headline on the newspaper said, Harlem Mob Chases Mayor. The words were so big they took up the entire page. Up above, in smaller letters, it said, "Go back down to Hymietown." The old man was wearing a pair of purple and white striped running sneakers. They looked weird on such an old man, but there was nothing really odd about them, not on the D-train. Kramer scanned the floor. Half the people in the car were wearing sneakers with splashy designs on them and molded soles that looked like gravy boats. Young people were wearing them, old men were wearing them, mothers with children on their laps were wearing them, and for that matter, the children were wearing them. This was not for reasons of young, fit, and firm chic, the way it was downtown, where you saw a lot of well-dressed young white people going off to work in the morning wearing these sneakers. No, on the D-train, the reason was they were cheap. On the D-train, these sneakers were like a sign around the neck reading Slum or El Barrio. Kramer resisted admitting to himself why he wore them. He let his eyes drift up. There were a few people looking at the tabloids with the headlines about the riot, but the D-train to the Bronx was not a reader's train. No. Whatever happened in Harlem would have exactly no effect in the Bronx. Everybody in the car was looking at the world with the usual stroked-out look, avoiding eye contact. Just then, there was one of those drops in sound, one of those holes in the roar you get when a door opens between subway cars. Into the car came three boys, black, 15 or 16 years old, wearing big sneakers with enormous laces, untied but looped precisely in parallel lines, and black thermal jackets. Kramer braced and made a point of looking tough and bored. He tensed his sternocleidomastoid muscles to make his neck fan out like a wrestler's. One-on-one, he could tear any one of them apart. But it was never one-on-one. He saw boys like this every day in court. Now the three of them were moving through the aisle. They walked with a pumping gait known as the pimp roll. He saw the pimp roll in the courtroom every day, too. On warm days in the Bronx, there were so many boys out strutting around with the pimp roll, whole streets seemed to be bobbing up and down. They drew closer, with the invariable, cool, blank look. Well, what could they possibly do? They passed on by, on either side of him, and nothing happened. Well, of course nothing happened. An ox, a stud like him, he'd be the last person in the world they'd choose to tangle with. Just the same. He was always glad when the train pulled into the 161st Street station. Kramer climbed the stairs and came out onto 161st Street. The sky was clearing. Before him, right there, rose the great bowl of Yankee Stadium. Beyond the stadium were the corroding hulks of the Bronx. 10 or 15 years ago, they had renovated the stadium. They had spent $100 million on it. That was supposed to lead to the revitalization of the heart of the Bronx. What a grim joke. Since then, this precinct, the 44th, these very streets, had become the worst in the Bronx for crime. Kramer saw that every day, too. He started walking up the hill, up 161st Street, in his sneakers, carrying his AMP bag with his shoes inside. The people of these sad streets were standing outside the stores and short-order counters along 161st. He looked up, and for an instant he could see the old Bronx in all its glory. At the top of the hill, where 161st Street crossed the Grand Concourse, the sun had broken through and had lit up the limestone face of the Concourse Plaza Hotel. From this distance, it could still pass for a European resort hotel from the 1920s. The Yankee ball players used to live there during the season, the ones who could afford it, the stars. He always pictured them living in big suites, Joe DiMaggio, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig. Those were the only names he could remember, although his father used to talk about a lot more. Oh, golden Jewish hills of long ago. Up there at the top of the hill, 161st Street and the Grand Concourse had been the summit of the Jewish dream, of the new Canaan, the new Jewish borough of New York, the Bronx. Kramer's father had grown up 17 blocks from here, on 178th Street, and he had dreamed of nothing in this world more glorious than having an apartment someday in one of these grand buildings on the summit, on the Grand Concourse. They had created the Grand Concourse as the Park Avenue of the Bronx, except the new land of Canaan was going to do it better. The concourse was wider than Park Avenue, and it had been more lushly landscaped. And there you had another grim joke. Did you want an apartment on the concourse? Today you could have your pick. The Grand Hotel of the Jewish dream was now a welfare hotel, and the Bronx, the promised land, was 70% black and Puerto Rican. The poor, sad Jewish Bronx. When he was 22, just entering law school, Kramer had begun to think of his father as a little Jew who, over the course of a lifetime, had finally made the great diasporic migration from the Bronx to Oceanside, Long Island, all of 20 miles away, and who still trundled back and forth every day to a paper carton warehouse in the West 20s in Manhattan, where he was comptroller. He, Kramer, would be the lawyer, the cosmopolitan. And now, 10 years later, what had happened? He was living in an ant colony that made the old man's tract colonial three-bedroom in Oceanside look like San Simeon, and taking the D train, to work every day in the Bronx. Right before Kramer's eyes, the sun began to light up the other great building at the top of the hill, the building where he worked, the Bronx County Building. The building was a prodigious limestone Parthenon, done in the early 30s in the civic modern style. It was 9 stories high and covered 3 city blocks, from 161st Street to 158th Street. Such open-faced optimism they had, whoever dreamed up that building back then. Despite everything, the courthouse stirred his soul. Its 4 great facades were absolute jubilations of sculpture and bas-relief. There were groups of classical figures at every corner: agriculture, commerce, industry, religion, and the arts, justice, government, law and order, and the rights of man. Noble Romans wearing togas in the Bronx. Such a golden dream of an Apollonian future. Today, if one of those lovely classical lads ever came down from up there, he wouldn't survive long enough to make it to 162nd Street to get a chocopop or a blue shark. They'd whack him out just to get his toga. It was no joke, this precinct, the 44th. On the 158th Street side, the courthouse overlooked Franz Siegel Park, which from a 6th-floor window was a beautiful swath of English-style landscaping, a romance of trees, bushes, grass, and rock outcroppings that stretched down the south side of the hill. Practically nobody but him knew the name of Franz Siegel Park anymore, however, because nobody with half a brain in his head would ever go far enough into the park to reach the plaque that bore the name. Just last week, some poor devil was stabbed to death at 10 a.m. on one of the concrete benches that had been placed in the park in 1971 in the campaign to provide urban amenities to revitalize Franz Siegel Park and reclaim it for the community. The bench was 10 feet inside the park. Somebody killed the man for his portable radio, one of the big ones known in the district attorney's office as Bronx attaché cases. Nobody from the district attorney's office went out into the park on a sunny day in May to have lunch, not even somebody who could bench press 200 pounds the way he could, not even a court officer who had a uniform and legally carried a .38 ever did such a thing. They stayed inside the building. This island fortress of the power, of the white people like himself, this Gibraltar in the poor, sad Sargasso Sea of the Bronx. On the street he was about to cross, Walton Avenue, 3 orange and blue corrections department vans were lined up, waiting to get into the building's service bay. The vans brought prisoners from the Bronx House of Detention, Rikers Island, and the Bronx Criminal Court a block away for appearances at Bronx County Supreme Court, the court that handled serious felonies. The courtrooms were on the upper floors, and the prisoners were brought into the service bay. Elevators took them up to holding pens on the courtroom floors. You couldn't see inside the vans because their windows were covered by a heavy wire mesh. Kramer didn't have to look. Inside those vans would be the usual job lots of blacks and Latins, plus an occasional young Italian from the Arthur Avenue neighborhood and once in a while an Irish kid from up in Woodlawn, or some stray who had the miserable luck to pick the Bronx to get in trouble in. The chow, Kramer said to himself. Anybody looking at him would have actually seen his lips move as he said it. In about 45 seconds, he would learn that somebody was, in fact, looking at him. But at that moment, it was nothing more than the usual. The blue and orange vans and him saying to himself, the chow. Kramer had reached that low point in the life of an assistant district attorney in the Bronx, when he is assailed by doubts. Every year, 40,000 people, 40,000 incompetents, dimwits, alcoholics, psychopaths, knockabouts, good souls driven to some terrible terminal anger, and people who could only be described as stone evil, were arrested in the Bronx. 7,000 of them were indicted and arraigned, and then they entered the maw of the criminal justice system, right here, through the gateway into Gibraltar, where the vans were lined up. That was about 150 new cases, 150 more pumping hearts and morose glares every week that the courts and the Bronx County District Attorney's office were open. And to what end? The same stupid, dismal, pathetic, horrifying crimes were committed day in and day out all the same. What was accomplished by assistant DAs, by any of them, through all this relentless stirring of the muck? The Bronx crumbled and decayed a little more, and a little more blood dried in the cracks. The doubts. One thing was accomplished for sure. The system was fed, and those vans brought in the chow. 50 judges, 35 law clerks, 245 assistant district attorneys, one DA, the thought of which made Kramer twist his lips in a smile, because no doubt Weiss was up there on the 6th floor right now, screaming at Channel 4 or 7 or 2 or 5 about the television coverage he didn't get yesterday and wants today. And Christ knew how many criminal lawyers, legal aid lawyers, court reporters, court clerks, court officers, correction officers, probation officers, social workers, bail bondsmen, special investigators, case clerks, court psychiatrists. What a vast swarm had to be fed. And every morning, the chow came in. The chow and the doubts. Kramer had just set foot on the street when a big white Pontiac Bonneville came barreling by, a real boat, with prodigious overhangs front and back, the kind of 20-foot frigate they stopped making about 1980. It came screeching and nosediving to a stop on the far corner. The Bonneville's door, a gigantic expanse of molded sheet metal about 5 feet wide, opened with a sad torque pop, and a judge named Myron Kovitsky climbed out. He was about 60, short, thin, bald, wiry, with a sharp nose, hollow eyes, and a grim set to his mouth. Through the back window of the Bonneville, Kramer could see a silhouette sliding over into the driver's seat vacated by the judge. That would be his wife. The sound of the enormous old car door opening and the sight of this little figure getting out were depressing. The judge, Mike Kovitsky, comes to work in a greaser yacht practically 10 years old. As a Supreme Court judge, he made $65,100. Kramer knew the figures by heart. He had maybe $45,000 left after taxes. For a 60-year-old man in the upper reaches of the legal profession, that was pathetic. Downtown, in the world of Andy Heller, they were paying people right out of law school that much to start. And this man, whose car goes thwop every time he opens the door, is at the top of the hierarchy here in the island fortress. He, Kramer, occupied some uncertain position in the middle. If he played his cards right and managed to ingratiate himself with the Bronx Democratic Organization, this thwop was the eminence to which he might aspire 3 decades from now. Kramer was halfway across the street when it began.
"Yo, Kramer!"
It was a huge voice. Kramer couldn't tell where it was coming from.
"You cocksucker!"
What? It stopped him in his tracks. A sensation, a sound, like rushing steam, filled his skull.
"Hey, Kramer, you piece of shit!"
It was another voice. They...
"Yo, fuckhead!"
They were coming from the back of the van, the blue and orange van, the one closest to him, no more than 30 feet away. He couldn't see them. He couldn't make them out through the mesh over the windows.
"Yo, Kramer, you Jaime asshole!"
Jaime? How did they even know he was Jewish? He didn't look... Kramer wasn't a... Why would they... It rocked him.
"Yo, Kramer, you faggot! Kiss my ass!"
"Hey, man, you stick up your ass! You stick up your ass!"
A Latin voice. The very barbarism of the pronunciation twisted the knife in a little farther.
"Yo, shitface!"
"Hey, you kiss us all! You kiss us all!"
"Yo, Kramer, eat your mother!"
"Hey, man, fuck you! Fuck you!"
It was a chorus. A rain of garbage, a rigoletto from the sewer, from the rancid gullet of the Bronx. Kramer was still out in the middle of the street. What should he do? He stared at the van. He couldn't make out a thing. Which ones? Which of them? From out of that endless procession of baleful blacks and Latins. But no, don't look. He looked away. Who was watching? Did he just take this unbelievable abuse and keep walking to the Walton Avenue entrance while they poured more of it all over him, or did he confront them? Confront them? How? No. He'd pretend it wasn't him they were yelling at. Who was to know the difference? He'd keep walking up 161st Street and go around to the main entrance. No one had to know it was him. He scanned the sidewalk by the Walton Avenue entrance, which was close to the vans, nothing but the usual poor, sad citizens. They had stopped in their tracks. They were staring at the van. The guard. The guard at the Walton Avenue entrance knew him. The guard would know he was trying to get away and finesse the whole thing. But the guard wasn't there. He'd probably ducked inside the doorway so he wouldn't have to do anything himself. Then Kramer saw Kavitsky. The judge was on the sidewalk about 15 feet from the entrance. He was standing there, staring at the van. Then he looked right at Kramer. Shit, he knows me. He knows they're yelling at me. This little figure who had just emerged, thwop, from his Bonneville, stood between Kramer and his orderly retreat.
"Yo, Kramer, you yellow shitbird!"
"Hey, you bald-headed worm! Aye, you stick a bald-head up a soul! Stick a bald-head up a soul!"
Bald? Why bald? He wasn't bald. He was losing a little hair, you bastards, but he was a long way from being bald. Wait a minute. Not him at all. They'd spotted the judge, Kavitsky. Now they had 2 targets.
"Yo, Kramer, what you got in a bag, man?"
"Hey, you bald-headed old fart! You shiny old shit for brains! Got your balls in a bag, Kramer?"
They were in it together, him and Kavitsky. Now he couldn't make his end run to the 161st Street entrance, so he kept walking across the street. He felt as if he were underwater. He cut a glance at Kavitsky, but Kavitsky was no longer looking at him. He was walking straight toward the van. His head was lowered. He was glaring. You could see the whites of his eyes. His pupils were like 2 death rays burning just beneath his upper eyelids. Kramer had seen him in court like this, with his head lowered and his eyes ablaze. The voices inside the van tried to drive him back.
"What you looking at, you shriveled little pecker?"
"Yeah, come on. Come on, worm dick."
but the chorus was losing its rhythm. They didn't know what to make of this wiry little fury. Kavitsky walked right up to the van and tried to stare through the mesh. He put his hands on his hips.
Yeah? What you think you looking at? She, gonna give you something to look at, bro.
But they were losing steam. Now Kavitsky walked to the front of the van. He turned those blazing eyes on the driver.
Do you hear that? Said the little judge, pointing toward the rear of the van.
What? Says the driver. What are you?
He didn't know what to say.
Are you fucking deaf? Said Kavitsky. You're prisoners. You're prisoners. You're an officer of the Department of Corrections.
He started jabbing his finger toward the man.
You're prisoners? You let your prisoners pull this shit on the citizens of this community and on the officers of this court?
The driver was a swarthy fat man, pudgy, around 50 or some gray-lard middle age, a civil service lifer. And all at once, his eyes and his mouth opened up without a sound coming out, and he lifted his shoulders and he turned his palms up and the corners of his mouth down. It was the primordial shrug of the New York streets, the look that said,
"Eh, what do you want from me?"
And, in this specific instance,
"What do you want me to do, crawl back in that cage with that lot?"
It was the age-old New York cry for mercy, unanswerable and undeniable. Kavitsky stared at the man and shook his head the way you do when you've just seen a hopeless case. Then he turned and walked back to the rear of the van.
Here come Jaime.
Chew my willy, Your Honor.
Kavitsky stared at the window, still trying to make out his enemy through the heavy mesh. Then he took a deep breath. And there was a tremendous snuffling sound in his nose and a deep rumbling in his chest and throat. It seemed incredible that such a volcanic sound could come from out of such a small, thin body. And then he spit. He propelled a prodigious gob of spit toward the window of the van. It hit the wire mesh and hung there, a huge, runny yellow oyster, part of which began to sag like some hideous, virulent strand of gum or taffy with a glob on the bottom of it. And there it remained, gleaming in the sun for those inside, whoever they might be, to contemplate at their leisure. It stunned them. The whole chorus stopped. For one strange, feverish moment, there was nothing in the world, in the solar system, in the universe, in all of astronomy, but the cage and this one gleaming, oozing, pendulous, sunlit gob of spit. Then, keeping his right hand close to his chest, so that no one on the sidewalk could see it, the judge shot them the finger and turned on his heels and walked toward the entrance to the building. He was halfway to the door before they got their breath back.
Yeah, fuck you too, man. You wanna, you try that.
But their hearts weren't in it anymore. The grisly esprit of the prison van uprising had fizzled in the face of this furious, blazing little steel rod of a man. Kramer hurried after Kavitsky and caught up with him as he was going in the Walton Street entrance. He had to catch up with him. He had to show him that he was with him all along. It was the two of them out there taking that insidious abuse. The guard had reappeared at the door.
"Good morning, Judge," he said,
as if it were just another day at the island fortress of Gibraltar. Kavitsky barely looked at him. He was preoccupied. His head was down. Kramer touched his shoulder.
"Hey, Judge, you're too much."
Kramer beamed, as if the two of them had just been through a great battle shoulder to shoulder.
"They shut up. I couldn't believe it. They shut up."
Kavitsky stopped and looked Kramer up and down, as if looking at someone he had never seen before.
"Fucking useless," said the judge.
"He's blaming me for doing nothing, for not helping him." But in the next instant, Kramer realized that Kavitsky was in fact talking about the driver of the van.
"Well, the poor son of a bitch," said Kavitsky. "He's terrified. I'd be ashamed to have a job like that if I was that fucking terrified."
He seemed to be talking more to himself than to Kramer. He kept on talking about this fucking whatever and that fucking whatever. Their profanity scarcely even registered on Kramer. The courthouse was like the army. From the judges on down to the guards, there was one all-purpose adjective or participle or whatever it should be called, and after a while it was as natural as breathing. No, Kramer's mind was racing ahead. He was afraid the next words out of Kavitsky's mouth were going to be, "Why did you just fucking stand there doing nothing?" He was already inventing excuses. I couldn't tell where it was coming from. I didn't know if it was from the van or... The fluorescent lighting gave the hallway the dim, toxic haze of an X-ray clinic. "This Jaime business," Kavitsky was saying. Then he gave Kramer a look that clearly required a response. Kramer didn't know what the hell he had been talking about. "Jaime?" "Yeah, here comes Jaime," said Kavitsky. "Worm dick." "What difference does that make, worm dick?" He laughed, genuinely amused by the thought. "Worm dick. But Jaime, that's fucking poison. That's hate. That's anti-Semitic. And for what? Without the Yiddish, they'd still be laying asphalt and looking up shotgun barrels in South Carolina, is what the fuck they'd be doing, the poor bastards." An alarm went off. A frantic ring filled the hall. It pounded Kramer's ears in waves. Judge Kavitsky had to raise his voice to be heard, but he didn't even look around. Kramer didn't bat an eye. The alarm meant a prisoner had escaped, or some skinny little thug's brother had pulled out a revolver in a courtroom, or some gargantuan tenant had grabbed a 130-pound hearing officer in a hammerlock, or maybe it was only a fire. The first few times Kramer heard the alarm on the island fortress of Gibraltar, his eyes jumped around and he braced himself for the clatter of a herd of guards wearing military box-toed leather shoes and waving 38s, running along the marble floors trying to catch some nutball in super graphic sneakers who, jacked up by fear, does the 108.4. But after a while, he ignored it. It was the normal state of red alert, panic, and disarray in the Bronx County building. All around Kramer and the judge, people were swiveling their heads in every direction. Such sad faces. They were entering Gibraltar for the first time, on Christ knows what sad missions. All at once, Kavitsky was motioning toward the floor and saying, "Is this, Kramer?" "This?" said Kramer, desperately trying to figure out what the judge was talking about. "These fucking shoes," said Kavitsky. "Ah, shoes," said Kramer. "They're running shoes, Judge." "Is that something Weiss thought up?" "No," said Kramer, chuckling as if moved by the judge's wit. "Jogging for justice. Is that what Abe has you guys doing, jogging for justice?" "No, no, no, no." More chuckles and a big grin, since Kavitsky obviously loved this line, jogging for justice. "Christ. Every kid who sticks up a red apples in my courtroom wearing these goddamn things, and now you guys." "No. You think you're gonna come in my pot looking like this?" "No. Wouldn't think of it, Judge." The alarm kept ringing. The new people, the new sad faces who had never been inside this citadel before, looked all about with their eyes wide and their mouths open. And they saw a bald-headed old white man in a gray suit and a white shirt and a necktie, and a balding young white man in a gray suit and a white shirt and a necktie, just standing there talking, smiling, yakking, shooting the breeze. And so, if these two white people, so obviously a part of the power, were just standing there, without so much as lifting an eyebrow, how bad could it be? As the alarm rang in his head, Kramer grew still more depressed. Right then and there, he made up his mind. He was going to do something. Something startling, something rash, something desperate, whatever it took. He was going to break out of here. He was going to rise up from this muck. He was going to light up the sky, seize the life for himself. He could see the girl with brown lipstick again, just as surely as if she were standing right next to him in this sad, grim place. Chapter 3. From the 50th Floor. Sherman McCoy walked out of his apartment building holding his daughter Campbell's hand. Misty days like this created a peculiar ashy blue light on Park Avenue. But once they stepped out from under the awning over the entrance, such radiance. The median strip on Park was a swath of yellow tulips. There were thousands of them, thanks to the dues apartment owners like Sherman paid to the Park Avenue Association and the thousands of dollars the association paid to a gardening service called Wiltshire Country Gardens, run by three Koreans from Maspeth, Long Island. There was something heavenly about the yellow glow of all the tulips. That was appropriate. So long as Sherman held his daughter's hand in his and walked her to her bus stop, he felt himself a part of God's grace. A sublime state it was, and it didn't cost much. The bus stop was only across the street. There was scarcely a chance for his impatience over Campbell's tiny step to spoil this refreshing nip of fatherhood he took each morning. Campbell was in the first grade at Taliaferro, which, as everybody, tout le monde, knew, was pronounced Tolliver. Each morning, the Tolliver School dispatched its own bus, bus driver, and children's chaperone up Park Avenue. Few, indeed, were the girls at Tolliver who did not live within walking distance of that bus route. To Sherman, as he headed out onto the sidewalk, holding Campbell's hand, she was a vision. She was a vision anew each morning. Her hair was a luxuriance of soft waves like her mother's, but lighter and more golden. Her little face, perfection. Not even the gawky years of adolescence would alter it, he was sure of that. In her burgundy school jumper, her white blouse with its buttercup collar, her little nylon backpack, her white knee-high socks, she was an angel. Sherman found the very sight touching beyond belief. The morning shift doorman was an old Irishman named Tony. After opening the door for them, he stepped outside under the awning and watched them depart. That was fine, fine. Sherman liked to have his fatherhood observed. This morning he was a serious individual, representing Park Avenue and Wall Street. He wore a blue-gray nail-head worsted suit, custom-tailored in England for $1,800, two-button, single-breasted with ordinary notched lapels. On Wall Street, double-breasted suits and peaked lapels were considered a bit sharp, a bit too garment district. His thick brown hair was combed straight back. He squared his shoulders and carried his long nose and wonderful chin up high. "Sweetheart, let me button your sweater. It's a little chilly."
"No way, Jose," said Campbell.
"Come on, sweetie. I don't want you to catch cold."
"N-O, say ho, N-O."
She jerked her shoulders away from him. Say ho was Jose, backward.
N-O.
So Sherman sighed and abandoned his plan to save his daughter from the elements. They walked on a bit.
"Daddy?"
"Yes, sweetheart."
"Daddy, what if there isn't any God?"
Sherman was startled, bowled over. Campbell was looking up at him with a perfectly ordinary expression, as if she had just asked what those yellow flowers were called. "Who said there isn't any God?"
"But what if there isn't?"
"What makes you think? Did somebody tell you there wasn't any God?" What insidious little troublemaker in her class had been spreading this poison? So far as Sherman knew, Campbell still believed in Santa Claus, and here she was beginning to question the existence of God. And yet, it was a precocious question for a 6-year-old, wasn't it? No two ways about that. To think that such a speculation...
"But what if there isn't?"
She was annoyed. Asking her about the history of the question was no answer. "But there is a God, sweetie, so I can't tell you about if there isn't." Sherman tried never to lie to her, but this time he felt it the prudent course. He had hoped he would never have to discuss religion with her. They had begun sending her to Sunday school at St. James Episcopal Church at Madison and 71st, That was the way you took care of religion. You enrolled them at St. James, and you avoided talking or thinking about religion again.
Oh, said Campbell.
She stared out into the distance. Sherman felt guilty. She had